You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
Welcome, everybody, to a very important episode of the podcast. You're tuned into episode 74.
We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today.
My guests this week are...
My name is Don Newkirk. I'm a writer, an artist, and a producer. Worked with some other artists like Lauryn Hill, Black Flame, Prince Paul, obviously. We've done a lot of work together. Brookville, and a couple of movie scores like, you know, like the one that's out right now, Who Killed Malcolm X, the six-part docuseries on Netflix. One that we're very little known for, which is Pootie Tang. but we're definitely there in the credits.
As for myself, my name is Prince Paul. People might know me from Stetsasonic, De La Soul, produced the first three albums. The Gravediggers, which people obviously know RZA from The Gravediggers, as part of that group. Handsome Boy Modeling School, Big Daddy Kane, Queen Latifah, Slick Rick, Boogie Down Productions, Beastie Boys. It's a lot. If I keep going, it's gonna sound like I'm bragging, and I don't want to come off like that, you know.
In times of turmoil and darkness, I've always turned to the arts to seek wisdom and understanding. Great episode here as we dive into Who Killed Malcolm X, which premiered on February 7th on Netflix, and with everything going on in the world, it seems like the perfect time to urge people to watch it, listen to the soundtrack, and fully engulf yourself, because years and years later, the revolution will not be televised. You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. So whether it's their vinyl or you listening to this podcast, every set of ears helps. BedroomBeethovens.com is the website, and Patreon.com/BedroomBeethovens is where you can give. Not sure if you knew this, but podcasting is an essential business, and this is a Black-owned podcast. These issues are important to me, and I am honored to share a bit of Newkirk and Prince Paul's 10,000-hour journey as we touch a bit on Malcolm X, the civil rights movements, and more. Well, Prince Paul, you at one point you were DJ Paul, and at one point that name worked out for 3/6 DJ Paul, but whoever decided that name wouldn't work for you, well, I guess hindsight's 20/20.
Hey, and I told him, you know, DJ Paul. I was like, yo, when I met him, he's like, yeah, DJ Paul. I was like, DJ Paul. I was like, yo, do you know people tease me for the name? That was my name. I was like, oh, man. And he made it work and stuck with it. And it's highly respected for DJ Paul.
Well, it all worked out, obviously. And with everything that's going on in the world, I can't tell you how beautiful it is to have two people that have been hanging out, working together, creating together since junior high, and the culmination of this relationship through 2020, through this turmoil, through the classic albums that you're known for. We have this beautiful project about Malcolm X, and it's an absolute honor to have you both here.
Oh, man. Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
True soul brothers, you know?
That's true.
True soul brothers, man.
Now, Don, do you know why Paul almost flunked out of junior high due to Motor Booty Affair? Do you know the story?
I do know the story, yes, actually. I do know the story.
I know that this magical middle school building that you two found each other in, you had a music teacher who was like the drummer of the Isley Brothers who performs with Surface. It was like there was something funky in that building from the start.
Yeah, there was something funky about Amityville from the start. It's not just
that's true.
It wasn't just the high school and the junior high. It's just the entire town, I think it is, man. There are so many known and unknown, unsung artists, producers, rappers, really, really dope cats that like all come out of Amityville. I don't know if it's like because it was the melting pot for the city with all the parents trying to get away and have a better life. So everybody came from everywhere else. I don't know if it's that or, you know, if it's just the fact that something in the water. I don't know which one it is, man, but it was pretty crazy out there.
Yeah, the only thing that I know is he was a new teacher when you guys started there. And prior to him being there, he started the Marching Tiger Band, the Fantastic Drum Line, the Honors Band, the Jazz Band, the Concert Band, the Pit Band. So before him, there was no real advocation for the arts, at least in that middle school, which was a shame.
Wow, you know more about Mr. Collins than I do.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, we should get it. I didn't know all that either. We should get him interviewed, man.
Yeah, it's funny. He had DM'd me recently, first time in a long time, which was very nice. And yeah, it's a long time. Wow.
Yeah, and Don, I had Steve Arrington, who was here last month from the funk group Slave. So, yeah, I'm putting you two on the podcast Mount Rushmore of the greatest funk artists who have done it.
Man.
Yo, he sang at Peanut Butter Wolf's wedding. I met him briefly. That's a nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, him being on Stone's Throw, that was a big get for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, let me be transparent here that like, you know, when you were introducing yourself, Paul, you're like, you know, let me, you know, I call you guys like, you know, one of the greatest funk legends. You're a veteran in the game. Do you guys cringe at remarks like that? Because like, Don, you were groomed to be like the next Prince. And when we talk about Prince Paul, their knee jerk reaction is to call you one of the goats. Like, do you guys embrace your veteran status in the industry?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, you gotta love the answer.
I mean,
if the shoe fits.
Yeah, I mean, you know. the whole you know, baby Prince thing, I guess you could call it. I never really vibed with that too tough, and I tried to stop Russell from doing that the best I could because I just thought it was too early. The man was still alive. You know what I mean? I was like, you know, we don't need another Prince. There's already one running around the industry doing his thing. You know, I mean, I got it. I got the reference, and I was definitely heavily influenced by the brother. You know, he definitely sparked. He was the reason that I switched from MCing to like producing and making like, you know, songs. You know, it was the freedom that he put across on records. But I was never in any way trying to be him. If anything, I was trying to be Mick Murphy from The System. More so. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's cool. I mean, I'm not mad at it. They could have called me worse things. They could have called me Sammy Davis Jr. or something, which still wouldn't have been bad.
He's an icon. Okay,
so yeah, that still wouldn't have been bad. So, you know, to be compared to any icon is like, you know, pretty amazing, but also heavy shoes to try to fill also.
Do you think that, like, maybe the reason why New Jack Swing, the genre, didn't really take off is because of Russell being jumping the gun like that? Or do you think it was because, like, NWA and gangster rap kind of took over a year or two later?
I think New Jack Swing took off. I don't think I took off within New Jack Swing because I don't personally believe I was a New Jack artist. I think more so I was more in, like, an experimental funk realm. But some of the, like, the single that they picked, I Desire, kind of had a New Jack vibe to it. There were like two songs on the album that kind of had a New Jack vibe. So I guess that's how I got pigeonholed into that. But like the other stuff on the album, like Sweat You and Fanatic Love and Double Dutch on the Sidewalk, that stuff was like totally like completely outside of New Jack. I had respect from the New Jack guys. I remember I ran into Devontae Swing at the Apollo and he was like, yo, I love what you're doing, man. I love your album. I was like, really, man? Thanks. And then he said, yeah, we should work together. And then that was right before Jodeci blew up. And then I saw them again and he didn't even remember me. He's like, yeah, what's up? I was like, oh, okay. But yeah. So the accolades were cool from my peers and everything. That was dope.
Well, I mean, it kind of pains me to hear that you weren't completely happy, because like even as a young man, when you got signed to Original Black Recordings, before Paul could step in and introduce you to Def Jam, I heard you weren't too happy at the time either.
Well, yeah, OBR. Well, that was Paul's doing actually, because it was OBR. It was Russell's OBR situation actually that Paul introduced me to. I went to a few labels before that. I think one of them was like Sleeping Bag or something like that. And I almost did a single deal with another label, which probably would have been a completely different career, because the demos that I was doing before I got to OBR, to Russell's label, they were different. They were more system-esque, I guess you would say. Like when I ran into Mick Murphy at that time also at a Grammy party, and Mick was like, yo, oh man, I love your album. I was like, really? I was like, dude, I'm just trying to be you, like literally, like I'm just trying to do my best Mick Murphy on vocals and my best David Frank on synth. And he was like, really? He's like, no, I don't hear that, but I like it. No, I mean, I had a good time at OBR. I just thought I think the music industry at that time, I thought it was pretty weird.
Yeah, I didn't know OBR was, I knew that Rawl Records was part of Def Jam. I didn't know what OBR was.
Yeah, OBR was like Russell's R&B offshoot label of Def Jam.
See, that needs a documentary. Personally, I'd love to know where like the Black Flames and Allison Williams, the first lady of Def Jam, and it was just a very different time for not only hip hop but R&B and music in general, like you said.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Yaya from the Black Flames is singing lead vocals for Surface, back to Surface again. He's been on the road with them for about a good 6 years, I think.
Well, in the end, I'm just glad that By Every Means Necessary Volume 1 cover is the way it looks and it doesn't have a giant neon peace sign on it.
No doubt. Shout out to Zan.
Well, Malcolm X, you know, he played a tremendous role in the civil rights movement. You guys were born right off of the civil rights movement. So paint me a picture, your personal experiences on what it was like in those times and the music from that era.
It's funny, when you're a kid, you don't recognize it. But when you look back and when you go through a neighborhood, they go, what you doing in this neighborhood? And you get chased out. and then years later, you go through the neighborhood and it's kind of okay. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it makes you realize like, okay, those were different times. And then you look back and when you learn the history, it's like, that's why it was different times. You know, things was just starting to, you know, come to some type of, for lack of a better word, some type of normality, because it's tense, you know. I remember when I was in school, and this doesn't happen anymore, thank God, but they were race riots, you know what I'm saying? Like, I clearly remember that. Yeah, I remember like sixth grade, fifth grade, somewhere around there. So things like that was still happening. I mean, it was intense. I mean, you know, I got along with everybody and everybody seemed to get along with me, like all races and whatever, because you're kids. But, you know, there were still, I guess, certain things impressed from those times, you know. So that to me was made it different. And then, you know, you got to remember there was songs stemming from that time, like, you know, What's Going On and Stevie Wonder, when he was singing, the Motown sound. And so a lot of those things kind of influenced time. Gil Scott-Heron, if you want to get more political, the Black poets. So we kind of came up off of that in that era, you know. Then it ushered in the disco era, which was something totally different. But, you know, we've talked about early 70s. It was kind of a transitioning moment.
On the sixth day of the riots, the civil rights were signed. And I mean, would you label this the modern civil rights movement? I don't know, but we're way past day six and I have a 8-year-old daughter and I'm wondering what she's going to take away from this. You know, if we're comparing and contrasting between the civil rights movements and what we're dealing with now, I think the biggest difference I can see is the use of cell phone cameras and being able to upload it online. And these incidents are going viral.
The revolution will be televised.
He wasn't lying.
Yeah. It will be televised.
Well, just a few years ago, you know, you guys released the Brookzill project, whose the musical direction was birthed from a trip, Paul, I think you had like 14, 15 years ago to Brazil, and you were tired of the commercial machine. You were bored of how music was starting to sound. What about film and TV? Is there a reason why Howard Shore and Hans Zimmer and Danny Elfman have just a majority share in what gets scored and pushed? And maybe people are bored and tired and they look to Nine Inch Nails to score a Facebook movie or get Kendrick Lamar to oversee a Black Panther soundtrack. Maybe what you were feeling in 2006 is the reason why directors are looking for people like RZA and yourselves to score films now, you know?
You know, I never thought of that at all. You know, it's weird. It sounds, you know, it might look at times as some things I might do are calculating music wise, but I'm a super, and I have to admit it, emotional creature. So wherever I'm feeling at the time kind of draws whatever music I'm making. So, you know, I probably went to Brazil at the time and not really knowing what the outcome might be, but once I'm like, oh man, the U.S. sucks with music, I'm going to live out here, you know, whatever emotional state I was in, and then try and then put something together, you know what I'm saying? Work with my man Rodrigo initially and putting a concept together by enjoying the music. It's just like a lot of things, you know, go 3 feet high and rise, and almost any record I made is usually just off of some weird emotion I was in at the time. And then you figure out, once the smoke clears, you go, wow, that was the result of that? And whatever the influences may be, you go, whoa, okay. You know, it makes me look way smarter than I am, you know, to be honest.
Well, Don, how do you keep up with that?
By being as smart as Paul. Back to that Amityville water, man. You know, it's very interesting. Back to Amityville, like I never had a very, very deep connection to the civil rights movement. I guess because my my dad was an entrepreneur, and my mom was a homemaker, but she worked as well. She was a single mom. So I don't think she had time to get caught up too tough in the civil rights movement. And my dad was working too hard and trying to build a legacy. So he didn't get caught up too tough in the civil rights movement. So it was never a big to do in our house, in the household. You know what I mean? Whether I was at my dad's house or living with my mom, it was always present in the background because you couldn't, you know, you saw it on television. You heard the music. I think more than anything, the music had its effect in my life more than anything else. You know what I mean? Because the music did get played in the house. But back to Amityville, man, it's like, I feel like a lot of the cats in Amityville probably had the same type of experience because it was just something about Amityville that was just so almost like middle America. It was like we were almost disconnected from the average. Don't get me wrong, there were average people there. You had your thugs, plenty of them. You had your thugs, you had the hood cats, you had the gods and the earth. You had all of the elements, but because they all coalesced in this town, it just didn't have the same sting, I think, as it did elsewhere in New York. So I guess that's what also led to the freedom of thought that so many of us have from Amityville. And a lot of people I know from Amityville, just pretty smart people, just generally, like, you know, a lot of the people that went to our high school and the surrounding high schools just have a way of thinking that's just different. It's just progressive. You know what I mean? It's not your average mindset.
Yeah. And here are the details that I like too, that made this documentary good. You have someone like Phil Bertelsen who approached you guys, right? He was the last to arrive to what was an adoptive family with six other kids. He had two children from Korea, one Caucasian. His brother was left on a stoop of a local church. Then you had himself. He had a biracial African-American and then three children born to his Norwegian parents. So obviously, he grew up in a relatively diverse but segregated suburb of central New Jersey. His family was the only family of color in that part of town. And what happens? He goes on to make documentaries about Martin Luther King, Barack Obama, and now Malcolm X. So it's clear that something happened to him where these issues became very important to him.
Wow. Are you FBI? You have so much intel. Yo, it's amazing. I'm like, what? I'm learning things about people I didn't know. This is truly informative.
Yo, I was going to say the same thing.
I'm trying to make this worth your time, gentlemen. That's all.
Yo. I had no idea.
This is the first time I knew less about myself in an interview. You know what I'm
man.
But the reason why I bring that up is because, like Phil, I think this went for a lot of families where they were raised in an environment that did not entertain conversations about three things, you know, race, religion, and money.
Right, right.
And I'm not entirely sure why, but when those subjects happen to come up, they usually lead to like an uncomfortable debate. Maybe that's why in 2020, something like this was made. Maybe people aren't afraid to voice whether they're a leftist or right or centrist. On the flip side, maybe that's why in 2020 we have racist cops that, you know, while they're being filmed, they still think they feel protected and comfortable. They think they're invincible. So maybe there's a flip side to it. I don't know.
Yeah, good point.
True. They do feel invincible. I mean, hey, I think with as far as the cops are concerned, what we're witnessing is the coming of, you know, what David Duke said he was going to do. You know, he kind of put a manifesto forward, you know, maybe 20 years ago, where he said, you know, when he got outed as a Grand Dragon, when he was trying to run and they shut him down. And he said, that's okay. He said, I'm going to take all of my skinheads. We're going to tell them to grow their hair in, and we're going to put them in places of power, like, you know, chief of police and mayors and presidencies and police and things of that nature. So I think that's what we're seeing right now. I think we're seeing, you know, the coming of the David Duke children, basically coming of age and to wreak havoc on, you know, colored people in the world, so-called colored people in the world. I think that's what we're experiencing right now. And that's why I think it's so blatant and they're so comfortable, is because they were just as comfortable when they had no hair on their head.
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, after seeing the film myself, and maybe for you guys involved, have you drawn your own conclusions about what happened to Malcolm X? Like, I'll even go first. Like, for instance, I believe J. Edgar Hoover ordered the hit on Malcolm. You know, that's what I believe.
I mean, it's not far-fetched at all.
Let's join in. If this is what the Negro wants, let's join him. Let's show him how to struggle. Let's show him how to fight. You don't need a debate. You don't need a filibuster. You need some action.
Malcolm was definitely one of the biggest threats to, you know, the establishment, because, you know, he couldn't be tamed, he couldn't be bought, and he stepped outside of the Nation of Islam, which made him that much more dangerous, because it was almost like they knew what was coming from the Nation of Islam. But when this charismatic, almost leader of the nation, which he wasn't, but, you know, someone that was looked at almost as a leader of the nation, steps outside of it and has no problem pointing the finger and naming names, you know what I mean? I think, yeah, I could totally see that.
Yeah, he was very transparent, and that automatically becomes a threat.
Yeah, I'm just like, the fact that Malcolm's killer could still be out there protected from prosecution, hiding in plain sight, that's the scariest part of it for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of them, the who they call the shotgun man, without spoiler alert for anyone listening, the shotgun man, you know, we know he's not going to be brought to justice, but there are still other individuals that were there that you know, didn't even make it into the documentary because it was just too hard, finding out who they were. All we had is Muslim names, and, you know what I mean? It's like almost impossible to identify these guys.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right. The chances are there's some old men walking around that, you know, pull the trigger.
Yeah, I think so many people pull the trigger, to be honest, right? Because everybody kind of had, not everybody, a lot of people had their finger on the trigger, per se. To get this done, definitely wasn't a one-man operation.
Oh, no, it was definitely like a five-man operation, and only one that, you know, we now know for sure, or for mostly for sure, who was one of the shotgun men, so to speak.
Yeah, I definitely urge everyone to see it and maybe draw your own conclusions. But what people may not know is, like, you both were in competition for this job to compose this documentary. Who else was there?
How'd you know that? How'd you know that? That's crazy.
But here's what I don't know, though. Who else was it? Was it mostly other, like, Howard Shores and Danny Elfman's, or maybe there were other rap producers that we might be surprised to hear were up for the job?
They never told us, actually. I actually thought about going back and asking Phil And
oh yeah, please do. I'm curious myself.
You know what I mean? I thought about that a couple of days ago. I was like, man, I wonder if he'd tell me now. Because they didn't tell us.
There was no one. I just put that on there to get you guys to work harder.
Very possible.
I'm gonna find out for you. I got my private eye hat still on. I'm gonna go find out.
Yeah, anybody can find out, you can.
Well, let me ask you guys, how did you feel about, you know, because you're people in the industry, how did you feel about this Blackout Tuesday movement this week where we're supposed to blackout social media, but Shady Records, Sony Music, Def Jam, Epic, Atlantic, Interscope, I mean, no label donated a dime. You guys are veterans of this industry. Are you surprised by this?
No.
The music industry is never something for nothing, you know.
It's always something for something. Q-Tip had it right and exact when he said industry rule number 4080. You know what I mean? So we know that they're shady. I didn't realize it until I became, you know, until I got signed to a label and saw the so-called inner workings. I was like, man, this is strange. It was just not like any other business model I had seen before, and it was uncomfortable, actually. So, no, I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, I think every major label PR exec is waking up to the biggest mistake they've made in their careers. They didn't take into account how basic hashtag algorithms work, and now complicit in restricting vital information flow to the community that needs it the most. So maybe they learned something. I don't know.
Maybe. I've realized that most labels and a lot of business in general don't get it until it hits their pocket.
That's America.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
This week, Run the Jewels came out with their album this week. I'm not sure if you guys had a chance to hear it, but there was it's good, but it's heavy though. There's a track on there called Walking in the Snow where Killer Mike raps. And every day on the evening news, they feed you fear for free. And you so numb, you watch the cops choke out a man like me. Until my voice goes from a shriek to a whisper, I can't breathe, and you sit there in the house on couch and watch it on TV. And after I heard that song, I was like, did he record that verse like the other day? And then LP was like, nah, we did that in 2019, but it could have been recorded this week. And unfortunately, this week is last week is last year is 50 years and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I really hope by the time that this interview gets posted, we see a little bit of change in the world. That's my hope.
I hope so. But I mean, yeah, going back to that line, I mean, that goes to show how from the time from Malcolm X, from the documentary took place to now, and obviously even way before then, things haven't really progressed as much as you would think it has. You know, we're still stagnant. It's crazy. So we could probably pull lyrics from you know, MCs, some from a Public Enemy record from the 80s and go like, was this written yesterday? It applies, sadly, you know.
On a lighter note, during the making of this album, Don, I hope you didn't spill any spaghetti on Paul's rug. Yeah. Nobody was harmed in the making of the soundtrack, I hope.
Oh man, yeah, it was RZA. Yeah, he spilled a whole plate of spaghetti on my rug. Back in the demo with Grave Diggers. Yeah, he's like, oh, yo, sorry, man. I was like, oh. Like, it's all right, man. It was a loud rug, too. It came with the place when I bought it. It was mad multicolored, so the spaghetti kind of blended in, you know. So,
I think you could put it on eBay. Like, hey, man, you know, this is RZA spaghetti. I don't know.
But, hey, that was a long time ago. Whoever's in that condo now, you know, I hope they changed the rug at least. That thing was really loud.
Well, before we get out of here, I kind of want to give you guys the floor to promote anything aside from the documentary, of course. I'm going to plug it in the show notes. Of course, I did not lose sight that the limited edition vinyl of said soundtrack and the cassettes are at lordbrothers.bandcamp.com. Maybe a possible volume 2 is coming because I noticed it says volume 1.
Yeah.
We left the possibility open. And the reason we did that is because we barely touched this, you know, we barely scratched the surface of all of the music that we had to create for the docuseries, man. It was 6 parts. So, you know, when we were putting the album together, we had to exclude a lot of stuff. We were like, well, we can do it as a volume 1 just in case, you know, we want to revisit it. There won't be a volume 3, but there may be a volume two.
Yeah, it's the plan.
Although there's enough music to do at least a volume three and possibly a four.
This is going to do a volume eight. What are you talking about? There's a lot of music.
We don't want to run it into the ground, though.
Right, we do an album called Run the Ground.
Run the Ground.
It's good. Go against Run the Jewels.
That is crazy.
Yeah, I don't.
I definitely wanted a cassette. I'm a little upset the cassettes are gone.
Yeah, the cassettes are sold down.
They sold out really fast. The album is still pushing. And Paul, you want to speak about the concept that we had? Just came up with actually before the interview.
We can mention it. In light of everything that's been going down, and we even thought about it, or at least kind of back in my head before it started. We're definitely going to donate a good portion of the proceeds of the album of the remaining pieces of vinyl that's left, because there's definitely people who are in need. There's a movement that's in need. And we're going to try to place the money in the hands that we think are, the most needy and who could do the best with it during these turbulent times. It's like we say, man, we got to give back to the community best way possible.
Well, I would be a poser if I did all this and I didn't buy the record myself. So I'm going to be honest with my listeners. I haven't bought it yet, but I am. I think there's 30 or so left on Bandcamp. One of those is going to get snatched up by me tomorrow.
Oh, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And let you know, it makes a great gift for your friends and family. It's a gift that keeps on giving. It's beautiful.
I like to gift people Montezuma's Revenge. I think that's a fantastic record.
Wow, nobody ever talks about that either, man.
It's amazing, man. I love it. And I feel like Adrian Young stole your shine 5 years later, but I listened to it.
Last 20.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. I like that record. It's just nobody ever talks about it. Go figure.
I like it, man. But not to put you in a corner though, but I did interview Dan the Automator before. I know there's chatter of Handsome Boy Modeling School on the horizon. Anything that we can disclose, or are we going to keep that hush?
I'll just say this, that the mustache has been getting thicker. The hair on top has been getting thinner, but the mustache is getting thicker. I'll just let's leave it at that.
The older I get, I find myself listening to Lovage more and more too. I know a lot of people don't.
Oh yeah, Lovage is great.
Yeah, I'm in my mid 30s now, and I'm like, man, I don't think I could have grooved to this when I was like 18. But this definitely now is the time. I've been going back to the old stuff.
Yeah, it's for people of a certain age. You might not get it as a youngster, but as you get older, you start to grow into it a bit. Yeah.
Well, age is like wine. It ages like wine.
Well, I don't want to wrap this up without not giving you guys the opportunity to disclose anything else. Did I miss anything? Anything else you guys want to talk about?
Nah, man. You covered all of it.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I want to urge the listeners to consume more revolutionary content. Don't allow this moment to be filtered through the establishment class media outlets. This includes social media. Read books about socialist revolutions. Watch documentaries like this one. Interviews about socialist revolutions. We become what we consume. So Prince Paul, Don Newkirk, thank you both for your time.
Man, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. This is a great interview, man.
Great interview.
You know a whole lot.
I'm impressed. Yeah, for real.